watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week, I devoted the entire show to a forum on the need for the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. Our speakers last week gave several reasons for it: a cure for royalism, defense of the Constitution, or maintaining the rule of law. More important than all those things is to halt the descent into fascism by asserting a challenge to the authority claimed by the people on the throne and those behind it. Fascism, when the power of the state is used to subjugate the people for the use of corporations, has been a recurring theme from the founding of the United States, even before the term was coined by Benito Mussolini. The U.S. Constitution is constructed in such a way that it enables its growth, while counter-movements toward liberty tend to require bloodletting and broken bones among the people, inflicted by the forces of law and order. An important question is why so many citizens of a country that gives so much lip service to freedom are so willing to embrace its opposite. We'll begin the program with a very interesting interview that explores that question. Then we'll conclude with a resumption of readings from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn, a feminist critique of the essential authoritarian nature and structure of exchange, that is, markets. George Kenney produces a blog and weekly podcast called Electric Politics at electricpolitics.com. Kenney was awarded a master's degree in economics from the University of Chicago and then, like his father before him, went into the U.S. Foreign Service. In 1991, when he was serving on the embassy staff in Yugoslavia, he resigned his position and his career in protest over U.S. policy in that country. His weekly podcast features in-depth interviews with a variety of prominent people, often establishment insiders or former insiders, who are clearly reveling in the experience of being invited to discuss their areas of expertise with an intelligent, open-minded, and sensitive person. What we're going to hear is one of Kenney's interviews with Dr. Bob Altemeyer, a psychologist who specialized for several decades in the study of authoritarianism from the point of view of the individual personality and its impact on society. This conversation took place on the 5th of October, and I thank a listener for bringing it to my attention. Here's George Kenney.
Today, I'm delighted to have as my guest Dr. Robert Altemeyer, or Bob, as he likes being called. Bob is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Manitoba, where he's been for the past 40 years, specializing in the study of authoritarian personality. His work has won a number of awards, both for research and teaching, including the Prize for Behavioral Science Research given out by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He's probably best known for being an often quoted primary source in John Dean's recent book, Conservatives Without Conscience. Bob's most recent book for the general public, titled The Authoritarians, 2006, is available for free online. Bob has his BA from Yale and his PhD from Carnegie Mellon, and he was born in St. Louis in 1940. Welcome, Bob.
How do you do? Glad to meet you.
Glad to meet you, too. Well, I'm not quite sure where to start. How about with the anecdote that you put in the early part of your book about how you got into this area of research, where there was a question on a PhD exam that you had to redo, and so was that the real reason why you got
it? Oh, absolutely, yes. Then to get a PhD, you had to pass some candidacy exam showing you knew your stuff in your field. One of the questions I was asked was about a very famous piece of research at the time on the authoritarian personality, which I had never heard of. Mm-hmm. I should have, but I was not as well prepared as I should have been for my exams. So I failed that question totally, and I passed the rest of the exam. So they gave me a conditional pass, but I had to write a paper showing that I had finally mm-hmm. heard about this famous piece of research.
Mm-hmm.
And that got me started. And if you're a Freudian at all, I'm not, but if you're any kind of Freudian, you know that one of Freud's successors had this idea that we all work really, really hard to overcome what we think is our major deficiency. And so I've spent the rest of my life trying to prove I understand authoritarianism.
I had just a few specific questions, so I'm going to have to kind of follow your lead once you get started. But I had a specific question to start, and this observation was also noted by John Dean in the last few pages of Conservatives Without Conscience. You suggest that your rough estimate for the percentage of authoritarians in U.S. society is about 20-25%. And I was just wondering, if I had to guesstimate, I would say something slightly under 20%. And I was just wondering how you arrived at your guesstimate, and if you have a sense of how that percentage, whatever it is, might compare with other countries.
I'm guessing like you are. So we should not ever quarrel about who's right, who's wrong about that.
Yeah, right.
It seems to me in the past that if you look at Watergate, for example,
mm-hmm.
At the very end and beyond the very end, there was a certain segment of the population that was going to stand by Richard Nixon until everything was over, and they'd still stand by him. So, and that was about 25% of the population then.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
George Bush is doing a little bit better than that in the polls nowadays. I don't think all of the people who support George Bush are hardcore, rock-bottom authoritarian supporters, but I think almost all of them are. So that if Bush is getting about 32 or 33% approval ratings and so forth, then almost all of that, I think, would be from these people who will go to the very end with someone they support, someone like George Bush. As to how that in the United States compares to other countries, I try real hard to stick close to data of some sort, and there haven't been studies that show that compare authoritarianism levels in the same kinds of samples and the same kinds of testing circumstances from one place to another.
So no one's taken your questions and tried to adapt them or translate them or anything like that?
Oh, that's happened a lot. But it's been used in a lot of different countries. But I'm a methodology maniac, and I know that you get different results depending upon whom you ask and the setting in which you ask and the instructions you give and what people think the survey is about and how representative the sample is and so on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I can, for example, take my data based upon my students here at the University of Manitoba and compare them with samples I drew at Harvard, where I'm the same tester is there and the same instructions and everything. And the Harvard students are much less authoritarian than my Manitoba students. And so if you were dumb enough, you'd say that shows Americans are less authoritarian than Canadians. At the same time, I could take data that I collected in the Deep South in the United States at various places and find just the opposite. So you really do need to take into account how representative the samples are. And any particular study is usually going to have some big flaw in that regard.
And then just one other guess about percentages, and then let's go to the heart of this questionnaire and the research program that you've been working on for all these years. Just as curious, what's your guess as to the percentage of authoritarians among university faculty?
Authoritarian leaders or authoritarian followers?
Well, both, I guess.
Okay, because they're different, and we
yes.
should get into that
yes.
before we go much further. Oh, God, I don't know. I've certainly known authoritarian leaders and had one as a department head for a very unpleasant period of time. So, yeah, they're around here and various other places, of course. And authoritarian followers, I suspect, significantly less than in the general population. One of the things we know is that there's a negative correlation between how much education you have mm-hmm. and how authoritarian you are. And one thing professors usually have is a lot of education behind them.
That's interesting. I actually should have thought of that before asking the question. I probably wouldn't have answered it because I did read that in your book. Okay, so let's I guess start at the beginning then. How did you begin to cook up these questions, and how did you conceptualize this whole research project?
I'll give you a short answer to that, and then with your indulgence, I'm going to give a speech so that the listener can understand, I hope, better what it is I think I'm talking about.
Okay.
I got the conceptualization through the inductive reasoning process. There had been this famous study of authoritarianism I referred to earlier, done in the 1940s. And then after that, there were lots of other people who came along and tried to measure authoritarianism. And as a result, there were a lot of scales around, attitude scales, personality tests that supposedly measured that. I just looked at all of the items on these scales. I gave them out to big samples of students and their parents at my university. I just looked at the items and tried to see what is really hanging together here and what is not hanging on at all. It's just somebody's wild idea. And the result of that inductive process of doing that over and over again for several years led to the conceptualization of the authoritarian follower. And that's the thing that I've studied the most. That's the thing that's been studied the most. There's also research now going on authoritarian leaders, and that came from a group of researchers who were then at Stanford University who developed a test that turns out to measure, I think, very well the kind of person who becomes a dictator or an authoritarian leader. So I'm just writing piggyback on their work.
Okay, well, and then the fuller explanation of it that you had in mind was...
Okay, now you're asking for it. You're asking for the long speech.
Yeah.
Okay, you can tell I'm reading from a script here now, just so I get it right. By authoritarianism, I mean something that leaders and followers cook up between themselves. The leaders demand submission, and the followers submit. Authoritarian leaders as dictators can arise in any system. Compared to most people, they psychologically have a high need to dominate others. They're power-hungry, manipulative, and immoral. That's a good description of my department head that some years ago that I was talking about. Authoritarian followers have much more submissive personalities than most people do, and they also aggress in the name of their authorities, and they insist that everyone follow the rules and norms laid down by their authorities. That's those three things, submission, aggression, and conventionalism, are the things that came out of that inductive reasoning process we were just talking about.
And that's the sort of the unique combination in your test.
That's right. That's what the scale that I have used to measure authoritarian followers gets at in lots of different ways. The extent to which the person believes in submitting to established authorities and aggressing in their name and making everybody else follow the rules of the authorities.
So some of your critics will pull out one of those three and say, well, you know, this doesn't really mean anything. You had a little exchange in the American Conservative, I guess, about that.
Yeah, there was an article in the American Conservative that that did that, and that was one of the many criticisms that they made of the scale.
Yeah, yeah. I read the book review and after reading your book, and I thought, well, the book review is really wrong. And then I read your reply to it, and well, anyway, go ahead.
Okay, we can just. I agree with you. It was really wrong.
It was completely wrong.
It may even be now that the guy who wrote the review thinks it's really wrong, but he was operating. He would make the same sort of mistakes that I would make if I was trying to criticize somebody in a field that I didn't know a whole lot about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anyway, I got to make a point here because it will save us a lot of trouble later on. I think. There are two kinds of authoritarian followers, the way I see things, depending upon who their authorities are. Some people submit highly to the established authorities in their society, and I call those people right-wing authoritarians.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean by right-wing something about their politics necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
It's a psychological thing, that they have a need to be on good terms with, to support the powerful established authorities in their lives.
They follow the law.
Well, we all follow the law, but they follow unjust laws.
Yeah, right.
As well as just, it doesn't occur to them there could be unjust laws.
Right.
There's another kind of authoritarian follower whom I think does exist, whom I call a left-wing authoritarian, because they follow authorities who want to overthrow the established authority in society.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't very many of these people around, but they pop up every now and then. We had the weathermen in the United States who they had certainly their authorities, and we had the Maoists on my campus during the early 70s who are always talking out of Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. So left-wing authoritarians exist again, and again, this is a psychological thing, not a political thing. A right-wing authoritarian can support almost anything. In the Soviet Union, we found, for example, when we were able to go in there and do the kind of straightforward research we do in North America, that the right-wing authoritarians, the people who scored highly on our measure of right-wing authoritarianism, in fact, supported the established authorities in their society, which was the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
And the Communist Party, I think we most people would say, is a very left-wing, politically and economically oriented party. So that illustrates what I mean when I say this test, which is called the right-wing authoritarianism scale. I'll call it the RWA scale a lot.
Mm-hmm.
This test really measures something about the personality of the person, not necessarily what the politics are and what their economic philosophy is. In the Soviet Union, right-wing authoritarians would be what we would call very left-wing politically and economically. But the right-wing authoritarian just supports whoever the authorities are in their lives.
So here in the U.S., then, right-wing authoritarians would coincide, for the most part, in any case, with the so-called conservatives or neoconservatives or Republicans. There's a huge overlap there, right?
Empirically, there is. It doesn't have to be that way in any country, but in the United States and in Canada, so we'll just say in North America, when you collect the data, you find out that people who call themselves Republican supporters score higher on this measure of right-wing authoritarianism than do people who call themselves independents or Democrats. And the difference is even bigger if you look at whether people call themselves conservatives or liberals. There you find an even bigger difference in the scores of these people.
Okay. So
that's the end of my speech, and I went off script for a while there.
No, it's fine. Well, I was wondering, okay, we have this scale for authoritarians, and then you have a similar scale for evangelicals, which again sort of largely overlaps with the authoritarians. But as I was reading your book, and by the way, people listening to this, it's a free book. Get it. It's a lot of fun to read, and it's very, very interesting.
Thank you.
well, it is. I was wondering, reading about the authoritarian and the evangelical type personalities, if there's any correlation that you know of or that anybody's tried to figure out with things like intelligence or other personality tests like the Myers-Briggs or the Minnesota Multiphasic or occupation. Are dentists, for example, more likely to be authoritarians?
I don't have to ask my dentist that sometime when I'm anesthetized.
After the procedure.
And before after the bill.
Yeah.
I just had your question. The basic answer is maybe a little bit. You want more than that?
Yeah. Well, take intelligence.
An intelligence test, such as the one that's most widely used for adults, the Wechsler, measures things like your vocabulary and basic mathematical skills, and it has some performance tests on it to see how you can change codes and put little blocks together to make a pattern out of red and white squares and so on. I don't think there's going to be a big correlation. There'll be a correlation between being an authoritarian follower and having lower intelligence than most people do. But that's not where you find out where the high RWAs fail mentally. High RWAs fail mentally when it comes to critical thinking, when it comes to just pure reasoning processes, when it comes to being aware of their own thought processes and looking for consistency in their own ideas, which they don't. And so there's a whole big literature, a whole lot of experiments that show there are those kinds of shortfalls in the authoritarian follower's mind. I don't think you're going to find much on intelligence, and when you do, it's mainly going to be due to the fact that, as we said earlier, the more you go to school, generally, the less authoritarian you turn out to be. I almost said the less intelligent you turn out to be.
Well, that there could be something to that, too.
Well, it's time for me to quit, then.
Let's go back to the reasoning and the conflicts in a moment. But I was curious about the Myers-Briggs also. Do you hold any stock in Myers-Briggs at all? I guess I should ask that first.
That I don't, but that doesn't mean other people shouldn't. There hasn't been, to my knowledge, a study of that. And since I've studied a lot of things about authoritarians, that tells you right there that the fact that I haven't looked at the Myers-Briggs indicates that I don't think it tells you anything that you particularly don't want to be told when you're answering the thing. But other people find it amazing and terrifically insightful, and they may be right. But I don't know of any studies. This question has come up a lot on the website as people have asked questions about this exact same question, and I've said all the time, somebody who's interested in this should do the studies and find out. So maybe in a year we'll know the answer to that.
One of the reasons that I thought of Myers-Briggs is because that is a main feature of State Department training, in a sense. Entering officers get it in a simplified form, but then when you're sort of making the jump into the senior service, sort of acquiring a flag rank equivalent in rank, you go through a much more intensive version of it. So the State Department thinks that it really helps their personnel to understand how to deal with each other. And in part, that's probably true because, as it turns out, State Department personnel are disproportionately introverted and unlikely to be very good at communicating with anybody. So.
Well, are they the same as professors or different in that way? Then bully for the Myers-Briggs. If it works in the State Department, then that's a plus for it, isn't it?
Well, it actually is useful. I'm just not sure what is true about it, why it works or whatever. But what about authoritarians and evangelicals on these scales correlating with mental illness, with insanity? Is there any kind of a correlation there? Would there be higher incidence?
I don't think so. Psychology has a bad history of calling people that doesn't like mentally ill, not the whole field, but some psychologists did. And I don't like authoritarian leaders, and I don't like authoritarian followers much, but I hope I don't go down that well-trod path and say these people are sick. Mental illness is something else again. There are aspects of authoritarian leaders that remind a lot of people of psychopaths, in particular the kind of psychopath whom some people call a sociopath.
Right.
And you can certainly find in authoritarian leaders, in their behavior and in how they answer the various scales that I give them and other people give them, that they have almost no conscience, that they are extremely manipulative, and so on. But they don't fill out the whole picture of being a psychopath, a sociopath, what in general is now called an antisocial personality. So that would be the one that comes closest. They'd probably score higher on a scale that measures that. I don't think they score higher on the MMPI scale, but they might well score higher on Robert Hare's measures of things. He's the one who's done the most research on psychopathology like that. Well, antisocial personalities, psychopaths. So
that's probably carrying it a little bit further than it can support. Okay, well, let's go back to the question of cognitive dissonance or internal consistency or whatever you want to call it, where you point out repeatedly in your book that people, authoritarian followers in any case, perhaps not the leaders, but the followers are absolutely impervious to factual argument and to rational argument.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary of it. It's very hard to dent them because they are so dogmatic about what they believe in. And they've got tremendous defenses against catching the truth when they're wrong and so on. And that, I think that goes back to where they get their ideas from in the first place. A lot of people, maybe most people, think things out for themselves. They get their ideas from their experiences as well as what they were taught, but what they were taught doesn't necessarily last for them for the rest of their life. Authoritarian followers mainly get their ideas from their authorities, and they sort of swallow them whole hog without reflecting on them, without being critical of them. They just buy the whole package. And when something comes along that says the package is wrong here or there, they've got a million ways of ducking it and not dealing with that. So they are very cognitively flawed, if you want to put it that way. I can name lots of ways that experiments show they are.
Well, for example, sure, let's take a couple of examples.
Well, all right, here. Here's a syllogism. All fish live in the sea. Sharks live in the sea.
Sharks are fish.
Therefore, sharks are fish. Now, that's not true. I mean, a lot of things live in the sea that aren't fish. So the fact that something lives in the sea doesn't by itself mean that it's a fish. Since sharks are fish, then authoritarian followers are to say, yeah, the logic follows there. If they like the conclusion, if the conclusion makes sense to them, they don't care that much whether the reasoning is sound or whether it's flawed. If I come along and I say the trouble in our country is due to an international Jewish conspiracy, and I give a lot of really stupid arguments for that, authoritarian followers are likely to believe that I've proved it because they didn't pay much attention to the reasoning. They liked the conclusion. If I come along and I say Saddam has amassed weapons of mass destruction and is going to attack us and everybody else with them, and the evidence is terribly flawed, superficial, and later on falls apart, that isn't going to make much difference to authoritarian followers. They like the conclusion. They don't particularly care whether the reasoning is sound, accurate, valid, and so on. Here's another one. You asked for. Do you want to talk about that one more?
Let's string a couple of them out here.
Okay. Another thing they do is that, which is really characteristic of them, is that they have highly compartmentalized thinking, which means that they've got all these ideas in their head stored in boxes, and the boxes live independent lives, and the boxes can contain quite contradictory ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So if you suppose you did an experiment and you asked people about who falls in love, and you said the basic thing about love is that opposites attract each other. Well, authoritarians are going to believe that. They're going to say, yeah, that's true, because they've heard it. It's a saying.
Mm-hmm.
They're like Pancho Sanza and Don Quixote, just full of sayings. If you then came along a minute later and said the basic thing about who falls in love is that birds of a feather flock together, they're going to say, yeah,
that's true.
Even though those are opposite ideas, they've heard both of them. They're each in a box they've got, and they contradict each other, but they believe both of them.
So another example that you give in the book has to do with freedom of speech, where it's the same kind of everyday saying, where freedom of speech is good, everybody should have freedom of speech. And then a minute later, well, there's some rabble-rousing leftist who's causing trouble, and we ought to lock him up. Oh, yeah, well, that's okay.
Yes. Now, we all do this to some extent. My wife delights in finding me making an argument that contradicts something else I argue with.
Mm-hmm.
So
I
don't think all of us have airtight, fully interconnected and integrated minds.
Sure. No, we wouldn't want that.
But, well, I would like to have that much integrity. But high authoritarians have a lot less of it than most people do. They have a lot more contradictory ideas. And that's why they can believe in such contradictory things like, I believe in democracy and at the same time and the freedom of the individual and so forth, and at the same time we should abolish the Bill of Rights because I don't like people to have those freedoms. And so they've got all these contradictory things in their heads, and they pull off whatever idea suits them at the time. I'll give you another example since you were talking about religious fundamentalism. Suppose you did an experiment in which you asked people, should public schools in the United States adopt a very Christian fundamentalist program? There'd be praying, Christian praying, Bible readings in school, and the major point of public school education would be to make children accept Jesus as their personal savior when they got to be teenagers. Authoritarian followers would really like that. And if you then say to them, well, what about the people in the public schools who aren't Christians and are they are Christians, but they don't want to make that kind of commitment and so on, the authoritarians will say, this is a Christian country. The majority rules. If the minority doesn't like it, they can go stuff it, go to a different school or whatever.
Leave the country or...
Yes.
Yeah.
Do it our way or else go away.
Yeah.
Now, suppose you did that experiment again using the same kind of people, except you give them a different situation. You say, suppose you lived in a country like, Egypt, let's say, some modern, westernized, I'm going to say democracy for the sake of argument because I didn't mention Egypt in the experiment.
Okay.
And that people there, it's an Islamic culture, and a fundamentalist Muslim government gets formed, and they determine that everybody in the public school system is going to have to learn Islam and read the Quran and do all the things, and the whole point of the public school education is going to be to make these people good Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And you have your kids going to that school. Would this be fair? The fundamentalist say, no, of course not. That wouldn't be fair at all. It would be just awful because the minority has rights. just because the majority wants this, I mean, the minorities pay school taxes and they're going to the school, and no public school system has the right to force a religious view upon somebody else's kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's compartmentalized thinking, and it also leads to hypocrisy, which you see often and often in these people.
I would guess that you're still amazed. I'm always amazed at how you can sort of explain that to somebody or point out to them that, that they're thinking entirely contradictory things, and yet they'll just keep on doing it. I guess that gets me. When I started reading your book, I was wondering about how do people get this way, and then I discovered in chapter two you explain it, but I'm still not sure I understand. And is that very much of an open question still? How do people become these authoritarian followers, or can you explain that a little bit for me, please?
Sure. How we get anyway is almost always a matter of the interaction of our genes and our environment.
Yeah.
It's quite possible, I think, maybe even likely, that there's a genetic basis for becoming an authoritarian leader or an authoritarian follower that has to do with aggressiveness versus how scared you get in threatening situations. So that may turn out to be true. There's some evidence that it's true. The evidence isn't convincing yet from twin studies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other side of the coin, the effect of the environment, which never operates independently of the genes and vice versa, but we can make very good predictions about how authoritarian submissive, how much one person will be an authoritarian follower, if we know some of the experiences they've had in life with regard to authorities in their lives and unconventional people and being aggressive toward other people and so on. If I give out this, what I call an experiences scale, to a batch of intro psych students who I've never seen before, I can make very good predictions about how they're going to score when it comes to answering the right-wing authoritarianism scale. The correlation, for those who care about these numbers, is about 0.70.
Wow, very high then.
Well, it's pretty high for this business. It's, it would make physicists to who deal with atoms and molecules and subatomic particles think that we're out in the wilderness. But for the behavioral sciences, that's one of the better findings. People are just very complicated and hard to predict. So we can do that if we know about their experience with authorities. The way that people sort of end up being authoritarian followers is that they don't have the experiences that most people have later on in life that would lower their sort of childhood authoritarianism, mommy and daddy are always right kind of attitude. And they don't have these experiences because they stick so closely to mommy and daddy. They stick so closely to the people that the mother and the father and their in-group endorse. They don't meet unconventional people, and they don't have experiences. They don't do unconventional things. I used the example in the book, you know, about if you have your first sexual experience at a certain time, you may find out that even though you've been told sex is awful and bad, it really is pretty neat. And you may have your first automobile accident, and you may have thought that driving wildly was great, and you find out it's awful.
Yeah, you have it both at the same time. It's
and
memorable.
You have both at the same time. You'll get a mixed message, but it's going to be memorable. Yeah, so the authoritarian followers, the future authoritarian followers, just travel in such tight circles that they don't have much experience in life. The interesting thing is that when they go to into a big public university like the one I teach at, they really change more than anybody else in terms of lowering their levels of authoritarianism. They start having, because I don't think it's the profs that do it very much, they just start meeting all these different people at a university than they met before in their lives, and they start getting broadened. And you said you went to school in Paris. You must have had some experiences like that. I know I would have if I had ever gone to school in Paris.
Yeah, sure.
And so as these people get out of those tight circles and start experiencing the great variety of human beings and sit up in the dorms and have bull sessions late at night about why do you believe this and why do you believe that, and they have to defend their ideas, they do change. They don't come out of university 180 degrees out of phase with what they were when they went in, but their level of authoritarianism goes down more over 4 years than somebody who goes into university and was not real high to start with. So I mean, that's a good sign. It shows that higher education works in this way. I'm not sure it works if you go to a private school where everybody is the same and you're all learning the same things that you've learned all the rest of your lives, and evolution is forbidden to be taught and so on.
Yeah, Regents University or whatever it is, yeah.
At an ordinary big old state university, education does lower authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It declines with education. It declines somewhat with age, I guess.
Levels of authority. Well, that's really interesting because what would you, if we got your college graduating class back together,
yeah,
and we had measured their level of authoritarianism, being an authoritarian follower. That's all we're talking about.
Right.
Now. We're not talking about the leaders.
Right.
If we had measured them when you came in the door, and we measured you 12 years later, say 8 years after you graduated,
mm-hmm,
what would we find?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I did that study at my university, I found that, first of all, over 4 years of education, their level of authoritarianism overall, the whole class, would have gone down about 10%. When you test them after they've graduated, so that's 12 years after the first testing and 8 years after they've graduated,
mm-hmm,
you find that by and large they still have relatively low scores. They haven't rebounded back, although we commonly think that as you get older,
you get more conservative.
You get more conservative,
mm-hmm,
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So then I did a study on other people, and I waited 18 years, and then I did the study again on other people, and I waited 27 years. That's just a study I did last summer.
Wow.
And so these people are now the 27-year-olds people. They're middle-aged. They've got teenage kids themselves,
mm-hmm,
by and large, and so on. And you find the same thing. In all three studies, these people as a group were less authoritarian at being in their 30s or 40s or so on than they were when they were 18, when they came in. So it just definitely does not confirm the stereotype that we get more conservative or more authoritarian as we get older or as we get mortgages and so forth. There's one other thing here I've got to say.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to ask me about it?
About tracking the trend in society, is that?
No, I was just going to put in this caveat. There is, within all of those alumni studies, as I call them,
mm-hmm,
there is always one group that has bounced back more toward its 18-year-old level than everybody else. And that is, I mean, what would do it? What would decide whether or not you had become more authoritarian after you graduated from college than everybody else? It's not whether you have a mortgage. It's not what kind of career you go into. It's you can be a low authoritarian and all of those things. It's whether you're a parent. When you have kids of your own, you find that your authoritarianism level goes up. Ask my kids. They'll tell you that's true. And that's just true in all 3 years. Now, they don't go back to where they were when they were 18. Education has a lasting effect.
Uh-huh.
Apparently a permanent effect higher education does at a place like my school. But it's a lot harder to be unauthoritarian when you've got a 2-year-old who wants to play in the traffic and a 15-year-old who wants to experiment with all kinds of drugs and other things.
Another thing that you found that I thought was quite interesting is that the general level of authoritarian followership tends to swing along with changes in society. So you had your lowest levels of authoritarianism in the, what was it, the 60s?
No, 19, the scale that measures this, which is called the RWA scale,
yeah,
the right-wing authoritarianism scale, measures being an authoritarian follower. That wasn't invented until the 70s. So I don't know what it would have been in the 60s. It probably would have been even lower than it was in the 70s. But in the 70s, it was as low as it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And the data, these data are all based upon the scores of incoming first-year university students answering the same questions in the same kind of classroom setting and so on. So the methodology is constant. Only the tester got older and fatter as the years went by. But then the scores just kept going up and up, and then they peaked in the mid-80s
mm-hmm.
when a lot of other things were peaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started going down. And right now they've been pretty steady, about halfway between the early 70s and the mid-80s. For about the last 8 or 10 years, they've about halfway in between. They haven't been changed much lately. But, yeah, it is very interesting that these 18-year-olds coming into university are carrying with them the attitudes of their times.
Right.
I mean, they've caught their culture by then.
Yeah, I should think it's a fascinating indicator, really. I don't know if you'd call it a leading indicator of politics, but some political consultant somewhere ought to be tracking this or trying to track it.
Oh, I am sure. I don't think they're using my scales, but I think that there are – you're quite right. There are political consultants all over the place tracking everything.
We've talked about the followers. Later on in the research project, you and others got interested in going back to ask questions about the leaders and found some interesting things about them.
Okay, yes. And this is all based upon a scale called the social dominance scale that was invented by Felicia Prado, who's now at the University of Connecticut, and Jim Sedanius, who is either at UCLA or Harvard,
mm-hmm.
I think, they were trying to measure this attitude of people being unequal, socially dominating, groups of people dominating other groups. And it turns out that you can use this to measure their scale to measure personal need for dominance.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are authoritarian leaders, and they would score very highly on the social dominance scale, the scale meaning that they do not believe in equality. They believe in inequality. And authoritarian followers don't score highly on this scale because they're not into dominance. They're into submission.
Mm-hmm.
A good example, although I don't think he's ever taken the test, but a really good example of an authoritarian leader, a high social dominator, would be the Vice President of the United States, I think,
mm-hmm.
Richard Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's the scale that we use to measure this. It basically asks you how much you believe in equality in various ways. We know from the answers that high social dominators give to other scales that they really are people you got to watch out for. They crave power. They believe in the law of the jungle. They agree with statements like, if you have power in a situation, you should use it however you have to get your way. And they say yes when you say, do you enjoy having the power to hurt people when they anger or disappoint you? They say, yeah, I like to hurt people then. They say, I enjoy taking charge of things and making people do things my way. I'll do my best to destroy anyone who deliberately blocks my plans and goals. So these are ferocious cats. They aren't always real skilled,
mm-hmm.
but they don't always get their way by a long shot.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they're fighting with other social dominators to become the king of the mountain. But they are power-hungry, power-driven, vengeful, highly aggressive people.
If you had to guess, looking at the universe of CEOs of major American corporations, what percentage of them would be of that type of personality, do you think?
I don't know. I think if you get to be the top of a lot of professions, you usually get there, or you may have to get there by tooth and claw, and somebody who is strongly driven to do that might be would be more likely to get to the top. I've never thought about what percentage of CEOs. Wouldn't you expect to find a high percentage of them there and elsewhere?
Yeah, I would wonder how many people weren't like that who managed to get to be CEOs.
I'm sure there are people like that who are not high social dominators who become leaders of lots of things. I mean, I don't think Martin Luther King
right.
was a social dominator. I think Mahatma Gandhi was a social dominator, and so on. But these are people who go after power, and they probably would end up on top more than people who don't go after power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're also pretty immoral. Amoral would be a better word to describe them. They're very exploitive, and they're very dishonest. They'll say things like, on scales we have that measure this, that there's no such thing as right and wrong. It all boils down to what you can get away with. One of the most useful skills a person should develop is how to look someone straight in the eye and lie convincingly.
Mm-hmm.
Deceit and cheating are justified when they get you what you want. There's a sucker born every minute, and the smart people learn how to take advantage of them.
Yeah, one that jumped out at me was the question about how you're supposed to preemptively attack someone if you feel it's in your interest.
Oh, yes, yes. That's this basic law of the jungle thing, that if you you should attack people because they're going to attack you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not an issue of whether you should. And you should just get in the first blow. Let me remind you of a decision to go to war in Iraq.
Yeah,
I don't really think myself that that was based upon a fear of Saddam, but upon a lot of other things.
Yeah, I think the same. well, and now you've also rather amazingly been able to apply several of these questionnaires to people in politics, although I don't know these days if anyone would still answer your questionnaires, but you were able to do that research for a while.
Oh, you're talking about the studies of American legislators.
Yeah, and why?
Yeah.
And Canadian too, right?
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, have you tried to do those repeatedly, or was that a one shot deal? Or
wasn't a one shot deal, but I think you're right. It would be hard to believe the results today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think many people know about this research.
Mm-hmm.
And I think legislators, politicians are very busy with other things. So I don't, maybe I'm making a bigger deal out of this than needs to be. But when I did the studies, and that was back in the late 80s and especially in the early 90s in the United States,
mm-hmm.
No one had heard of it. So you're right. It was a good time to study authoritarianism and prejudice and belief in liberty and equality and so forth. Among successful politicians, I sent out the RWA scale to almost all of the state legislatures in the United States between 1990 and 1993. There were 8 different studies altogether,
mm-hmm.
in which I would measure other things besides just right-wing authoritarianism. And I got back responses from about 1,200 legislators overall, and that was about 26% of the sample, which I thought was very good, but under the circumstances, since they're all very busy, they have that many answer it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And found some disturbing things. You have just a rundown of the list here?
Yeah, please.
Well, first of all, if you're looking at Republicans and Democrats, in every house that I surveyed, in every one of them except the Louisiana House of Representatives, the Republicans scored higher than the Democrats did on this measure of authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And then on supplemental scales that I put in, and this isn't going to surprise anybody, the high RWAs opposed equal rights legislation for gays. They favored a law restricting anti-war protests so that it could only be of a certain size, and they'd have to take place at designated times and at places away from the public view and so on. So, you know, impinging on the freedom of speech, political protest. They favored greater restrictions on Roe versus Wade. They favored giving the police more extensive wiretap and search and seizure and interrogation rules. They were opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment. They did not favor equality as a value at all. And lots of other things. So they... if you've been paying attention to what's been going on at your state legislature, none of this is going to surprise you, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that surprised me the most was that the RWA scale at that time had an item on it that all of these legislators answered. And the item goes, once our government leaders and the authorities condemn the dangerous elements in our society, it will be the duty of every patriotic citizen to help stomp out the rot that is poisoning our country from within. This is like something Nazis, I think, would say. When I read that statement, whenever I'm giving a talk to someone, I read that statement out. The audience usually laughs because it's so ludicrous in its extremity and so forth. And you'll be glad to know that most legislators disagreed with that.
Except
26% of them said that, yes, that was true. When the government condemns the dangerous elements and says stomp out the rot, then everybody should do that.
As you point out, that's half of a majority right there.
And that was done before 1994, before the religious right became so powerful and started sending more and more authoritarian leaders to public office.
And before 9/11.
And before 9/11, yeah. And it fits in with a whole lot of other studies on a measure I call posse. Suppose you did an experiment in which you said, let's imagine that someday the federal government condemns various journalists, and it says these journalists are dangerous, they're spreading bad ideas. And the government then says this is only going to be an effective process of getting rid of these journalists if the public cooperates.
Mm-hmm.
Would you, you know, tell the authorities about any journalists you thought were spreading dangerous ideas?
Hey, my neighbor's a journalist.
Right. And in fact, your neighbors live next door to a journalist, probably, if you consider yourself a journalist. And there are, would you help the authorities arrest this person if the authorities wanted to round up a group to attack some newspaper or some TV station or so forth? Would you participate in this attack? Would you, if the government said they could only find out about how widespread these bad journalists were if they tortured the journalist, would you support that kind of torture? And suppose the government said it had to kill the journalist, capital punishment for spreading bad ideas, would you go along with that? Well, almost everybody says no, they wouldn't do that. But some people say absolutely not, and other people say, well, I sort of slightly disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the high RWAs who are most likely to join a posse to write down anybody, it turns out, that the government condemns, even a posse to write down right-wing authoritarians.
They haven't figured out that's possibly not good for them, for their own interests.
Yeah, it's sort of like if the government came along and said, we've got to get rid of these people who are too submissive to the government, too aggressive in the name of the government, and keep insisting on everybody following the conventions favored by the government, would you help us round them up? And right-wing authoritarians are more likely to say yes. I mean, you might think that the leftists would want to round up these people more, but no, the right-wing authoritarians push to be in the front of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like you say, okay, you guys march yourself over to the jail and lock yourselves in, because by doing what you're doing the thing that we're trying to get rid of. So that's just another example of how lacking they are in insight.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Robert Altemeyer. The interviewer is George Kenney, host of ElectricPolitics.com. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.